Thanks for tuning in to the Greenpeace. That's spelt P-I-E-C-E. I'm Warren Green, your host and one of the storytellers of this weekly podcast, where I'll be telling campfire stories about sustainable safaris, misadventures, and travel tales from around the world. I have a number of interesting people, including safari guides, conservationists, lodge managers, and philanthropists lined up to share their stories and expertise with you. So, grab yourself a beverage, sink back into a comfortable chair, and enjoy the next half an hour with me.
The meal was hearty, the company was jovial, the setting remote. Bilimungwe Camp, located deep in the heart of the South Luangwa Valley in Zambia. We all sat under the eaves of the thatched roof, watching the night sky spiral around us, our glasses charged with a cognac, our tongues loosened around any topic that rose before the shooting stars fell. And then the heaviness of sleep sent us on our escorted ways to bed. I had barely removed my sandals before I was snatched from my mosquito net surrounded world and cast into a deep sleep. I woke 3 hours later, the warm glow of the Remy long gone, chased away by the goblins from overindulgence. I felt a dull rhythmic cerebral thud and a swollen bladder. The netted ghost tripped me as I staggered to the bathroom, wondering through the sleepy haze what in fact had stirred me from my never-never land. Business complete, I fumbled in the darkness, pulling at the many folds of the net before it finally parted, and I was once again able to collapse gingerly upon my pillow. I lay still, listening to the silence of the night. And then I heard it. The cabins at Bilimungwe are grand, made out of hewn natural timbers. The windows are gaping holes covered with taut lengths of fly screening. And the South Luangwa is a remote valley, a thriving ecosystem along the banks of the now idle Luangwa River. The sun bakes the valley for months, and then the rain floods everything, forever changing the course of the river and dispelling many big ebony, teak and fig trees on a long, crushing cruise to the Zambezi Basin. It was in the last few days of the baking sun that I was there, the river still lazy and the game teased by the scent of rain from the east. It was a deep, throaty, grunting, rasping, almost hoarse call that reverberated through the glade of our camp. The night air remained still. Nothing responded to the challenge. The baboons, normally chattering and chortling from their lofty roosts, were silent. The grazing impala did not even trot. Odd, since the leopard sounded as if it was inside my cabin, feet from my throbbing head. I waited for it to call again. I loved the sound. My blood raced as the image of the leopard in the night danced through my brain. I could see him walking steadily, head high, white-tipped tail flicking as he sprayed the bush, scuffing his hind legs in his emission and continuing on, stopping to rasp out his name and domain. Some moments passed, the bush held its breath. I did too, fearful that if I inhaled too deeply, I might miss the next utterance from the Prince of Cats. I was rewarded as the sound came in from the north, further away, softer. This time it was not quite as hoarse, not as loud, and not as deep. It was another. She was responding with more urgency than him. I lay, and I wondered at the outcome. Two leopard, a still night, a grass camp under the dawning sun. Still, I listened. Yards from my bed, I could hear the dried bapani leaves rustle under the weight of padded feet. I could hear the grunts of greeting. The rasping roar began, this time a duet, then deep growling as if emitted through a throat full of water, then a scary, tearing, almost guttural bark, pads on the leaves, and then silence. Once again, my mind raced, and blurry images sharpened. I imagined him, the bigger of the two, with his large block-shaped head mounting her, a smaller cat, crouched low on the ground, tail aside, muzzle wrinkled at the pain of entry, the growl of satisfaction at the withdrawal, and the hurried blur of claws, clawed paws lashing out at his neck, biting jaws. I could see him spring back in the darkness as she rolled over, showing her light belly and flashing white-tipped tail. He would stand yards away, gazing at his conquest, annoyance and delight, to roll over in the grass and watch for her next move. She would wait, the driving urge eventually stalking her close to him. She'd be crouched, sidling up to him, offering her tail to his face and rushing forward, enticing him to another brief joust. I could hear the calls. Indifferent to my sleeping companions and my prying ears, they continued into the darkness. I listened, tracking their moves away from camp, across the sudden break in the glade. Dumbo, dried earlier in the season, now a well-manicured grassland that had attracted herds of waterbuck, impala, baboon, and into the riparian forest that guarded our camp from the Luangwa River. The calls continued just until the false dawn. I could hear him heading south and her heading north. She must have started to hunt. The silent impala now blasted their sharp alarms, the sound ricocheting through the herd and then silence. The sound of hooves, a brief stampede, meant that she had been seen, smelt, or heard, then silence. From the far side, another call, a sharp blast, and once again, the herd ricocheting call echoing through the valley and then silence. From the back of the camp, the baboon could be heard waking, probably stirred to life by the impala. They were shaking branches, shouting long and hard. The big male's deep howls seemed to excite the shriller youngsters to greater levels of enthusiasm as the trees now became a cacophony of delirious asylum sounds. I lifted up on my elbow and watched the sky burn from dull grey through shades of orange as the sun clipped the Chindani hills and welcomed me to another day in the valley. My guest today is a renowned photographer. He does what I've just done with words with his cameras. He's taken images from the Serengeti all the way to South Africa. He's taken photographs of tigers in India. He immerses himself in culture. He knows his destinations like the back of his hands. A fantastic guy to be on safari with. He shares his knowledge of camera settings, composition, editing software, and all the intricacies of taking a great photograph and making it even greater. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a wonderful campfire discussion between myself and Andy Biggs, whose website is www.andybiggs.com. Why don't you have a look at that while we're chatting and you'll get a sense of the photographs that he takes. And the reason I've chosen to talk to Andy today and to tell you that story about the leopard is because that happens to be one of Andy's preferred camps in the South Luangwa Valley. It's a stunning location and a really beautiful place to go and experience Africa in its rawest. Today I'm chatting to a fantastic gentleman who's been associated not only with the continent of Africa, but has been all around the world dragging his bag full of cameras and lenses with him, recording dynamic images of life and wildlife and landscapes of this magnificent planet. Today I'd like to introduce you to a very special friend of mine, Andy Biggs. Hi, Andy, and welcome, and thanks for joining me at the Greenpeace.
Thank you so much for having me on, Warren. Thank you.
I'm excited to have you on, because what you've been doing is taking people over and exposing them to this wild continent of ours. I know one of your fortes is travel through Africa, and you've taken some really cool groups down there and taken some wonderful images. And I know that what you do influences the way and how people see Africa. When did you start? When did you fall in love with photography? And that's before you started taking photographic groups.
Great question. My first trip to Africa was in 2002, and I was taking a sabbatical from my corporate consulting career. And I had only picked up a camera maybe a year and a half before that. And so I had this dream in my mind, I'm going to go on safari and I'm going to take, you know, compelling photographs, and I'm just going to have a great time. What I didn't know is that halfway through that trip, I would fall in love with the continent, the areas that I was visiting, and I would build an entire business around it. And at that time, this was 2002, which is crazy. It's 18 years ago now. It was when digital photography was on the rise, and it was also at the same time when baby boomers were starting to travel. They were retiring. They were starting to enjoy the fruits of all of their labor over the years, but with a digital camera. So I built an entire business around taking people on safari into the bush, teaching them how to use their cameras, teaching them how to be good storytellers, because that's what photography really is. It's about telling a story. And we have the assumption that there are no words to go with the story. It's all visual. So how do you usher people or guide them or, you know, somehow coach them into these wonderful photographic opportunities to take advantage of them? So I was there to build a business around that. And I started doing that in the Serengeti. I thought, you know what, if I'm going to start a business around photographic safaris that are guided, where the guide is as a photographer teaching you how to photograph, why not do it around a place that has a name where you mention the Serengeti and there's a huge associations with what the Serengeti is all about based upon television shows, what we've read in books over the years, because it's such an amazing place. It's like the Super Bowl of wildlife, but it's also a Super Bowl. Sorry to use a North American term here, but it's this destination that has wide open places. It's wild. You know, just the Serengeti alone is 6,000 square miles. And to contrast that with the Masai Mara, it's 595 square miles. So it's a tenth of the size. Granted, you get into conservancies and other large areas that, you know, expand the ecosystem. But if you were to take the whole ecosystem as one, you're looking at over 15,000 square miles.
Yeah, it's quite a large piece of landscape that's been preserved. And thanks to the Frankfurt Zoological Society for jumping in and being the catalyst that they were way back when to establish the Serengeti biome. But so, Andy, I'm delighted that the Serengeti was what attracted you. But what were you doing in the corporate environment before you gave your briefcase up for a camera bag?
So out of university, I was an accountant, and I learned the language of numbers, and then I learned the language of financial software systems. So I implemented large-scale accounting systems for companies, and it was boring as hell. I did work in Singapore and London, and I was overseas all the time, and it was great in my 20s. And then I got married, and then everything changed, and I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area. And gave up my consulting career. And by the way, that consulting career, being in the service industry, taught me how to serve people. And that's my passion, is teaching, serving, being of value. And that's the same whether you're a teacher in a classroom, a guide in the safari world, a photographer teaching how to create great, compelling photographs. That's all the same. It's the same skill set where you're taking care of people. And so pivoting from something very analytical into something very creative was not really a big stretch for me at all.
I like that comment. And I think you've actually hit a very important touch point for, I suppose it's applicable to any industry where you are interacting with people who need your service, who need your product. To have empathy and to be able to relate to that person across the business table, across the seat of a Land Rover or a dining room table is critically important. During my days at Sabi Sabi, that was one of the very first fundamental lessons that we were taught in our ranger training program. Now, you would think being a ranger, the first priority is to understand the ecosystem and be equipped with all sorts of really interesting knowledge about how the ecosystem works, which is true. You need that. But without it being paired with the right level of guest or personal empathy, you're going to fail as a guide in every respect. So it's a wonderful attribute that you identified so early on in your career. And I'm sure the people who travel with you must feel special as a result. They must do.
Well, I hope, you know, it's certainly a goal. And I think there's another way of putting it. You used the word empathy, and that's a good one. Another one is humility, where you have to make sure that you are not the center of attention, of the attention. You are taking people into a place that they either know nothing about or a little bit about or have some minor assumptions about it. But it's your job to interpret nature, to teach them what I would consider to be like a slow safari. And this is something I'm very passionate about. I cannot stand the Ferrari safari approach. There are some operators out there who I think don't mind driving their guests around really fast and bouncing between sightings. And I think that's missing the point. The art of the safari is learning how to exceed expectations in all areas. But one of them is teaching people things that they knew nothing about and didn't think they would enjoy knowing about it. For example, if you're driving a vehicle, and I still operate a vehicle in the Mara, driving a vehicle and you come across something interesting, and what you do is you interpret it, and you know what it's like. You tell people what it is, what it's doing, why it's doing it, and then my job is to also add in there how to photograph it. And then at some point, your guests feel satiated and you move along. But what you have to realize is that as you're driving, and maybe you're not speaking for 30 seconds to a minute, that information is bouncing around through their head that you just told them about whatever subject you just stopped for. And they file it away. Some people file it away really quickly in the back of their brain. They don't want to recall on it again. And others go, wow, that's really cool. I just learned so much about the Ficus sycamoris, the sycamore fig tree, and how these specific... Yeah, no, but it's like, you know, they'll, I mean, you know, from guide school, it's like an entire ecosystem of its own. Yeah. And that's like, that is so thrilling in this world. It's thrilling. So I'm passionate about that for sure.
Well, it comes through, and it certainly your passion comes through your lens as well. You know, I was thinking about your initiation date when you decided to step out and into photography. 2000, you said 2002.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a scant year after that disastrous 9/11, which reverberated through the United States and obviously the rest of the world and shook us all to our core and changed the way people traveled. So it was also a really tough time to start out in the travel industry. How did you get your first client at that time?
You know, I could use some very colorful language here, but I don't want to say I lied through my teeth, but you have to beat on your chest, right? And you have to say, trust me, I'm trustworthy. You're going to have a wonderful experience. And the way that I did that is that I approached a well-known photography website that had a lot of readership. And I said, hey, listen, I'd like to write an article about going on an African safari for an extended period of time with digital photography equipment. This is 2002. People didn't know how to charge your batteries, how to download your cards, and in a situation where you're camping out for six straight weeks. And so I wrote that article, and what I realized is that people were contacting me saying, hey, listen, when are you going to run your own safari? Well, I already had it planned. And so I emailed the owner of the website and said, hey, listen, would you mind amending my article at the bottom and saying Andy is putting together a group for, I think that was January 2004. And he sent me a message saying, please call me. Let's do it together. And so we put it together. And so that brought me some credibility very early on in this industry. And then that safari, I ran through an operator in Tanzania. And we sold that safari in 24 hours, 12 people. Wow. And I approached them. I said, okay, I just sold the safari. Let's set up another one. And the owner of the company said, well, that's pretty awesome. Would you mind, what if we did six of these a year and we advertised your safaris in our brochures? Hey, let's do it. Let's go. And so that got me, that propelled me into the industry because there was such an immense need for this photographic instruction. 2002, I would say it's not gone away, but it's changed significantly. You know, a lot of people now they know their cameras. At least they know how to turn it on and take photographs and format their memory cards and download the images. Back then, that was all new. You know, you had people moving from film or had never even owned a camera before.
I know, and I think that the digital photography has transformed people's attitudes towards photography. Having grown up with a film camera in my possession and some rudimentary lenses, nothing really great at all, I still struggle to take good pictures. I remember being, you know, every time I pressed that shutter, I knew that that was the equivalent of $1.25 in processing. And then the slide mount would be another 20 cents or whatever. So every time I pressed my trigger,
yep.
I was it was costing me money. And also because I was living in the bush at the time, I didn't have a processing lab close by, and I would have to wait a couple of weeks before I could get my film processed and returned to me in slide form. And then you would go through everything and be heartbroken to find that that picture that you took at the time was either overexposed, underexposed, or you had a bit of dust caught in your lens and there was a scratch right the way across the film. Oh, it was heartbreaking stuff. And so I think I learned to be very conservative in taking pictures. And now with digital, I mean, you can just rattle away and have your camera set to these automatic settings, which will bracket and take pictures at different you really can't go wrong. And yet, I have to admit that I still battle to take pictures, pictures that I feel are worthy of somebody's dollar. So I'm very keen as an individual to come on a photographic trip with you to learn from the master, because I've seen your images and I think they're utterly stunning. And I'm sure people who travel with you must be inspired and get a lot out of each trip. How are you able to spend time with people on their own, or, you know, because you go with a group of people, right? You don't just go one-on-one.
Sometimes I do one-on-one, but it's not very cost efficient for people to pay for my travels all the way over there and to do that. So how do I do that? You know, I think you have to take the attitude that you're there for other people, not for your own photographs. And if you have the opportunity to take a photograph, do so, but only if your needs are underneath your guests' needs. So I've mastered the art of shooting over people's shoulders.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I think you can take photographs and at the same time be a coach and talk people through the process. And so let's say you're composing a photograph of some zebra that are in front of you and say, okay, guys, compose your photographs. Make sure you zoom out a little bit. Don't crop off the tail. Don't crop off the bottom of the hooves. And kind of walk people through how to assemble the composition of a photograph while still looking through your own camera. You can do that. You know, you can still be of value. And people find that educational, because you can take a photograph, then share the image with the back of your camera with your guests and say, well, here's my interpretation of what I'm seeing. You know, it's not the only, but this is just how I'm seeing it right now. And then let's just say I'm reviewing the photograph, and then I go, oh gosh, I can see that there's a tree growing out of the back of one of the individuals. And I turn to the guide and say, hey, would you mind moving 3 or 4 meters forward so we can change the composition a little bit? And so we start the vehicle, move forward, we stop, and we take some more photographs. So it's like this iterative process of take photograph, review photograph with your guests. Everybody looks at it and says, oh, we can improve on it this way. You make changes, take some more photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but also as an agent, so I'm an agent and a guide. And as the agent side of me, I get these wonderful opportunities to visit properties either before or after my guests are with me. And that presents wonderful opportunities to actually slow down some more and take photographs. I tend to nerd out over the things that many of my guests don't enjoy as much.
Yeah. So what would those be?
Oh gosh. You want to go over some of the things I've seen the last few years? How about
that? Yeah, the things that you nerd out about. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Just a few examples. So this time last year, actually it was February of last year, I was in Samburu in northern Kenya, and I came five African wildcat kittens together, all looking at the camera at the same time from about 60 feet away. It was superb.
Just pause there for a second, because I think people sitting at home listening to our chat here might be thinking, well, cat, I mean, what's so difficult about photographing a cat, let alone seeing five wild cat kittens? You need to appreciate, and I'm talking to you, my audience out there, that seeing a wild cat in the first instance is not necessarily unusual, but it's unlikely. It's not a common sighting. Believe it or not, it's not as common as seeing a lion in the wild. And then to go on further and see kittens, these little babies, and see five of them is just utterly extraordinary. So, Andy, I hand you back the microphone so that we get the right perspective there.
So that happened February of last year. The next month, I was in the Delta in Botswana, and just outside of one of the camps that you represent, there was a brown hyena den. Mm-hmm. And these brown hyenas were not afraid of anything or anybody. And so we could come to the den and sit and be quiet and fill the frame with brown hyena pups. It was absolutely phenomenal. And then a few months later, last year, I was, what is another interesting thing? I've had so many amazing things that have happened in the last few years. I was in Luangwa in Zambia in August. And one of my neatest things I love is when I see my guests' faces light up because of something they didn't expect. It doesn't always have to be a wildlife sighting. It could be a moment. Yeah. And we were on a long bushwalk. I think we did about a 3-hour bushwalk. And we ended up at an outdoor pizza station. And you know you know where I'm talking about, too.
Well, and yeah. So you can honestly talk about Andy Hogg's Bush Camp Company. There's no problem in that at all. I know. I mean, he does things so extraordinarily well in that South Luangwa Valley. His little camps are just fantastic, and his product is so good. I actually want to share an experience with you about his camps. But anyway, talk about that pizza station for breakfast, because it's remarkable. It's a remarkable experience. So yeah, carry on. Talk about it. It's wonderful.
So we're doing our bushwalk. So we do, let's say we started our morning with a game draw. As the sun was getting a little higher in the sky, we got out of the vehicle and went on a proper walk. And it was a long one. It was probably a 3-hour one. And we ended up rounding the corner. And then next thing you know, there's an outdoor picnic table and a pizza oven, which is lit on fire, ready for us to roll out our dough and assemble our own pizzas. You know, there's something about cooking in the bush that's a lot of fun, but it's a lot, something about cooking in the bush when people don't expect it. And it's just a lot of fun. You know, people making smiley faces with their vegetables on the pizzas, and just being fun, you know, and drinking wine and knowing we're now going to be driven back to camp and we don't have to walk the 3 hours back.
Yeah, I mean, you chuckle. It really is a very, very special experience. And I don't know what it is. I suppose if I really gave it some thought and analyzed everything, I would be able to determine what it was. But the act of playing with your own dough, rolling it out and making that pizza topping, it's an extraordinary thing. But everybody that I've spoken to who has experienced the outdoor pizza with the Bush Camp Company absolutely and utterly raves about it. It is one of the highlight experiences to be had. Maybe we all don't spend enough time, you know, getting our fingers dirty with dough. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's an ancient ritual in the kitchen where you made bread that sort of comes out in us. But I agree. I absolutely agree. It's a terrific experience. It really is.
Well, this helps emphasize that in this industry that we're in, that when people use words like luxury, that means something different to one person than the next. So yes, it might be the thread count of one person's bed. To somebody else, it's making a pizza in the bush or a sundowner drink location where they have these this rush of feelings that come through your body at the end of a wonderful day in the bush.
Yeah,
you know, and so that's why I have a difficult time when I market trips of using these loaded words that actually don't really mean anything anymore. They don't mean anything because they don't convey all of what it's even difficult as a subject to talk about because, you know, like back to this word luxury. What does luxury really mean? Really, like to me, luxury is being in the middle of wilderness and nobody else being around. That to me is luxury. And my vehicle in the middle of nowhere, guests in the back, driving around, and as the sun is going down, you see nobody else's vehicle headlights anywhere. Nowhere.
Yeah.
That's my definition.
Well, I agree with you. You know, I suppose the dictionary writes up luxury as being sumptuous or extremely comfortable living or surroundings. And I think as we break away from our man-made structures and get closer to our essence and our core and at one with the wilderness, that becomes the luxury. And we don't do it as a species often enough. And I think it is exposure to the wilderness just gives you perspective in so many different levels. And my ideal of luxury is to be able to sit, I suppose the chosen platform would be an old log in the shade of an old sausage tree or maybe an old teak or an ebony tree and have this beautiful African shade over my shoulder while I gaze at nothing in particular, but just see the wilderness and wildness out in front of me. And maybe be distracted every now and then by a few ants carrying the pupa from one destination to another, or being distracted by a bee eater that's flying from one branch up into the air, grabbing at an insect and returning to that same branch, repeating that pattern, occasionally changing its flight path. To me, those moments are just so precious and dear because you lose your mind in a way. You just drift off into this other world environment where you are at peace and where you are at one.
It reminds me of something similar that happened a few years back. I was at Old Onyo Lodge in Kenya, and we had just gone on a long walk and came back and had a little bush breakfast and we're sitting there drinking coffee. And I was lying on a blanket with a beautiful pillow behind my neck, behind my head. And I was dozing off and everything was great until my crossed leg, as I'm lying down, my crossed leg crossed over and then I dumped all of my coffee all over my chest. The point is that I was so relaxed in the moment, soaking it all in no rush to get into the vehicle and go do whatever we were going to do next. It's just this is an overused term these days, but you know, to disconnect, to reconnect.
Yeah.
I think it's important. I think it's important.
Well, I think of you and how those moments must have had an impact on you. I know a couple of years ago, and honestly, for the fleeting second, I've gone absolutely blank on the name of that tremendous hurricane that struck the southern states of America and doused Texas and particularly Houston in water and flooded it for days. I think you were either there or you were stranded somewhere and had to get back, and your home was in Houston. Where were you when that happened?
Thankfully, I was actually at home.
You were there.
Yeah, I was at home. It flooded on a Saturday night, and then the water went away the next Saturday morning.
Wow.
And then I put a notice on Facebook, hey, I could really use some help, like tearing apart my house, getting all the wet things out of the house, furniture, the walls, everything. And that was on that Saturday. I sent the message out. Sunday, I had 35 friends and other people I didn't know show up and help me. On Monday, I was on an airplane to Kigali, Rwanda to go guide a safari. And so I... Yeah, it was horrible. It was crazy. It was crazy.
Yeah, it's coming back to me now. I remember the Friday before the storm, we knew the storm was coming. We didn't obviously all know how severe it was going to be. And Sue Smart, the CEO of Quando Safaris, was on a whirlwind sales trip around the United States. And she was scheduled to fly into Houston. And she and I chatted on the phone. I said, Sue, I mean, if you do go into Houston, I don't think you should stay there for too long because it's going to be challenging to get you out. I think we don't know yet, but the storm is looking really bad and fairly intense. She said to me, well, Warren, I really have to see Andy and I'm having dinner with him and I don't want to give up on that meeting. And, you know, for her, you were a very, very important person to come and see.
And it was appreciated. She got out of Houston. Her hosts that she was staying with, they were able to get her. I think they drove her to San Antonio to get her out.
Yeah, they eventually had to drive her out of there. She tried to make her way to the airport, but her car got swallowed up by a river, and she got picked up and then driven to San Antonio. Yeah, so she
and
did
now,
get out.
And like, right now, she's in the United Kingdom, away from Botswana.
Yeah, she's been chased out of her home because of the COVID virus, and she's trying to figure out how to best operate her business from, I think she's working out of the attic of her brother-in-law or a relative's home in the UK. Yeah, you're quite right.
These are challenging times for sure.
So I wanted to ask you, and I don't mean to pry too deeply into personal affairs, but that flood had a huge impact on me and the damage that it did, and it sort of brought home how powerful nature is and how violent this, I suppose, climate change phase that we're going through is. I was thinking somebody like you who's drawn automatically to look through the viewfinder of a lens, were you at all, I mean, I attempted to get out and try and take pictures to document that week while you were there, or was it just too stressful, too sad, and you had other priorities?
I had no interest in picking up a camera, none. And for disclosure, my home was flooded as a result of a dam being opened. And it was not from nature itself. It was from a collection system of water that was meant to save the city, ultimately filled up with too much water, and they had to release it. And they released it very quickly. And so it's as traumatic as it was for me. It took 14 months to rebuild the house, a lot of days in the bush guiding from an income standpoint to pay for the rebuilding of the house. And so I'm just glad it's past me. I don't ever want to see another flood again, ever. I had no desire to photograph that. There are certain things in life that I just don't pick up a camera for, and I don't care to do that. And this is one of them. I'm a nature photographer. That's really all I want to pick up the camera for. I don't even like to take photographs on general travel, you know, like domestic travel. Not interested at all. Just get me back to the bush. But I also love American landscapes, shooting landscapes in Scotland, going to the Galapagos Islands. And I love all nature, but there's one at the center, and that's African travel for me.
So I can appreciate when you're photographing in Africa, you have a number of lenses that you kind of carry as your stock lens. But if you're going to be photographing landscapes, like you've just mentioned, I mean, Scotland, which lends itself to shorter lenses, I suppose, the Galapagos, I suppose, is because the nature of the game down there, you can get so close to creatures, it's probably also a shorter lens. What is your standard arsenal for a trip to Africa? And also, I was just thinking, you know, after 9/11, carry-on luggage being such a tricky thing to maneuver now, and then the airlines charging super high fees for personal bags and things. How do you kind of balance that luggage restriction along with the preferred lenses to take on a trip? And if you don't mind telling me, what are those lenses? I promise you I'm not making notes.
It's okay if you are. First, let me surround this conversation by saying I don't have an obsession with gear. I used to love big lenses, and I was into the sharpest, whatever. But, you know, as I've gotten older, let's just call it more mature, I've realized that for me, I value the experience more than the photograph. Mm-hmm. So I'm willing to trade off the size of lenses to get smaller ones that are easier to carry and to get me into places where I can, where it doesn't interfere with the experience. Okay. Yeah. So for me, I have swapped around between kits over the years, mainly because I wanted to always know what my customers were shooting with and how to navigate the menu structures and just understand and have empathy for their own shooting needs. So I've gone from Nikon film to Canon digital, back to Nikon digital, and then back to Nikon to Canon digital, and then now I'm shooting with a small Fuji system. But I would say the most common lens over the last 18 years of doing this full time would be a Canon 100 to 400 millimeter lens on a Canon full frame camera body.
Yeah,
that's been like my go-to for absolutely everything. But these days, I would be more likely to rely on a 70 to 200. Yeah. I tend to be more of a mammal photographer than a bird photographer or insects, reptiles. And so the nature of shooting mammals is a little bit easier because you can fill the frame easier.
Yeah.
And my photographic style is that I tend to include the tops of trees. I like the environment, the clouds, if there are any. And to me, that's all part of the story. And so I am usually looking for two or more animals.
Mm-hmm.
If it's one animal, it has to be doing something unique. You know, mm-hmm. one thing we're taught when we, you know this from your Sabi Sabi days, we're taught to that all organisms on the planet do a minimum of three things. And they're staying safe, they're looking for food, and they're propagating. Mm-hmm. And if you're watching animal behavior, you can put all of their behavior in one of those three categories or more, like play mm-hmm. is a fourth category. So you have to think about, you know, what is your subject doing? You know, what is it thinking about? If you're photographing elephants, you're getting a lot more nonverbal communication about what their mood is, what they're thinking, what's going on, than other animals. And so I tend to photograph more than one animal or more than one species. I love it when like oxpeckers are on the back of a host, or there's some sort of implied relationship or interaction between two species. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So it gets easier to fill the frame when you've got more than one subject. So 70 to 200 is kind of, I think if someone were to buy one lens and go into nature, whether a landscape or wildlife, I would say buy a 70 to 200. It's sharper, it's faster, it's just easier. The tendency as a photographer is that whatever your longest focal length is, you're going to go straight to it. You've got a 100 to 400 millimeter lens, great. You'll find people at 400. The whole time.
Yeah.
And that I think is a very narrow view. Uh-huh. It's a very narrow view. You end up chopping off body parts, but you also end up, you know, every photograph looks the same. You turn the page, let's say you're showing a portfolio of images from a safari. You know, John went on a 2-week safari and came home with a bunch of photographs and printed off his favorite and put it into a book. And as you turn the page, you're thinking to yourself as the viewer, different subject, but it all looks the same. How do you take compelling photographs? Well, a good friend of mine used to be a photographic editor for National Geographic, not the magazine, but for mm-hmm. the books division, like the coffee table books and the calendars. And he told me one thing that was really so helpful early on. He said, as an editor, if I were to tell you to go do something, take some photographs, come back and give me all of your images. If I told you to take 7 different types of photographs, I'm going to be happy because I feel like you've covered all the bases that I need. And the 7 categories are, he needs an opener. Mm-hmm. He needs a closer. An opener might be this double page spread or just an image that sucks people in and makes you want to turn the page to see more. It's the hook, right? Mm-hmm. It might be a big, gorgeous landscape of Ngorongoro Crater. It might be of 2 big bull elephants sparring or fighting with their trunks up in the air. It, whatever it is, it's something that sets the hook and gets somebody emotionally invested in turning the page. So an opener and a closer. The closer could be a cliche. It could be a sunset. I could be photographing my group of photographers, and it could be a group photograph all standing underneath the wing of a bush airplane as we leave our safari, as we conclude this chapter. Uh-huh. Okay, so an opener, a closer, a wide angle shot, and a zoom shot. And what this does is that it gets people out of the mode of using the same lens all of the time. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we've got an opener, a closer, a wide angle, a zoom, a detailed shot, and that might be a dung beetle and might be the label of the beer from like a Kilimanjaro beer label in Tanzania. Yeah. It could be anything that's a detail. And then the sixth would be a portrait of a person. Guess what? For nature photographers, that's kind of hard to do.
Yeah.
So, okay. Opener, closer, wide angle, zoom, detailed, portrait, and the 7th is the hardest. It's what we call the special moment. It's that moment in time that will never happen again, ever.
Mm.
Okay? And it might be a wildlife moment. It might be a moment of people. It's a frozen moment in time. And now that you've got all those 7 categories, shoot them in both horizontal and vertical format. So every time you see something that where you're using your wide angle lens, try to shoot it in both vertical and horizontal. And so what it does is it breaks up this visual monotony of images where they all don't look the same.
Okay. Well, yeah. That's great advice. I mean, wow. from a lens to the whole way to do it. Do you carry a flash with you?
I have not carried a flash in probably 7 years. No.
Yeah, I must admit, I used to do a lot of nighttime flash photography, and in the end, I really just got fed up with the images because the flash it would flatten the image. It would take out so much of the detail because it's full on. You can't really bounce a flash in the wilderness. Was it for the same reason that you don't use flash?
No, it's that I prefer natural light. It's more flattering. It's more beautiful. And trying to merge the two is quite difficult. I know how to do it. But often due to time constraints or my guests might not have flash units, it just slows everything down. And it's easier to just not bring a flash. It's not often that I would have used it anyway.
Yeah.
These days with these cameras, with these high ISOs, you can shoot in low light. You often don't need a flash, you know. I'm going to take the opportunity to explain to people why you would use a flash.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so there are 3 situations where you would want to use flash. As the main light, where it's the brightest light source, it's brighter than the sun. As fill light, which would fill in shadows and be flattering. Let's say you're taking a photograph of a person. You would fill it in and it would fill in all the shadows. It's flattering. And then the third one is for a catch light in the eye. Just for a little catch light, like just a bright little spot on the eye. And there are certain subjects that have pure black eyes, some birds, but also some mammals like giraffe. So you have 3 situations where you'd use flash. And in the wildlife world, it's usually number two or number three. As a fill light, like you're photographing a bird of prey on a perch, and you just want to fill in the shadows a little more, or as a catch light.
I've often found taking pictures of animals so utterly depressing in the end because you get that dead eye.
Yeah.
It's beautiful composition, but the eye's got no light in it. It's just dead, and the entire image just lacks everything. It doesn't look alive. So for you guys listening out there, light in an eye somehow draws your own eyeball to that animal, and it comes alive off the page. It's that's a really good tip, Andy. Thank you.
Yeah. You bet. You bet.
Tell me now, at the end, when you've been on a trip and you've come home, do you work through your images or work through your guests' images with them? Will they learn a little bit about digital editing, some of the basic do's and don'ts, or is that territory that they need to navigate on their own?
I'm happy to help in any way that I can. And what I tell people is, if we get home and you need some help, call on me. We'll either do a screen sharing, or we'll make a plan for whatever your deficiency is in education or what your need is. Often, some people will say, you know what, Andy, I just need help with this one photograph. So they'll send me the raw file, I'll process that and send it back. Sometimes they say, you know what, I just don't understand processing at all. I send them a link to my Adobe Lightroom video instruction series. I give that away for anybody who goes on safari with me.
Oh, wow.
And it'll put you to sleep. It's 3.5 hours of content. Sorry. But so I try to fill that gap, whatever it takes. There was a time when I used to make prints for everybody. Used to have a large format printer and a studio, an office away from the house. But unfortunately, that printer went away with the hurricane, so I'm no longer doing that service. But you know what? Over the years, what I've noticed is that since 2002, people's knowledge of digital photography, how to process photographs, and how to print them has dramatically gotten better. Okay. Yeah. So my value is more in assembling a safari, putting it together. I understand logistics really well, costs, all that fun stuff that agents have to do. And then guiding the trip, making sure people get what they want. And from a trip leadership standpoint, being everything that I can be while we're out there. When we get back home, it's a one-on-one thing. You know, what do you need? And I'll make a plan for solving that. Yeah. So it's different.
Well, it's very different, and I appreciate all your comments there. And just to add to what you've said, you know, Andy, I've worked with you for some time now, and I've understood over those years your depth of knowledge when it comes to the African destination. And you're a man that speaks about the names of drainage lines that separate certain sectors of either the Mara or the Serengeti, or, you know, how to get from one camp to the other in the South Luangwa Valley and how long it takes to walk between them and what you're likely to see in terms of the topography along the way. My gosh, I mean, just earlier today we were discussing Lamala's properties and you were able to tell me the names, not just of the region, but specific kopis where each of their camps are located. So if anybody out there is thinking about joining Andy on a photographic safari, you're not just getting his expertise on exactly what we've been speaking about, how to take a picture, but you're also getting his expertise on the destination. And this is a man that is a seasoned traveler who knows the patterns of Africa, he knows the ways of nature, and so can get you into an area of Africa when the madding crowds have left it empty. And quite frankly, that's probably the most beautiful time to be there, where you can see these uninterrupted landscapes void of minivans or 4x4s and other people, and just appreciate nature for what it is. So you get a whole lot more from Andy Biggs than just a lesson in photography. And I'm very pleased to have such a professional agent involved in promoting and selling this continent, which is so, so special to me, Africa. And you do trips elsewhere. I mean, you're not just involved with selling Africa, right?
I do. I mean, I'll do some trips to India for tigers. I'll do Iceland trips for landscapes. I've done a few Antarctica trips, Galapagos every 2 years. I'll charter a yacht in the Galapagos. I go all over, but it's like this primary love. Africa is what really drives me. The other places I love, I just don't quite love them enough to build an entire business around them, right? And to me, being on the African continent, where you've got the megafauna unrivaled anywhere else in the world. It's just, and the hospitality, the hospitality system is so amazing. And you've been in this industry longer than I have. You know what it's like to have friends everywhere you go. All the camps, the managers, the guides, the trackers, the housekeeping, the back of house staff, the chefs, just everybody along the way. It's like one big family, and it's like no other. And I just cannot wait to get back.
Yeah, Africa is a special place. That aspect of hospitality is so very true. You know, you look at Africa's history and you read about the Tswane Wars and the amalgamation of the tribes and the hostility that existed on that continent and how much hostility there's been through, you know, Europeans trying to settle and tame certain areas of the territory. You get the feeling that Africa is this dark continent, this violent continent, this barbaric continent. But really and truly, you understand it. When you go and you meet Africans, they are warm, welcoming, most hospitable people. Probably people who would give you the last bowl of rice in their meager home if you were a hungry traveler. And I think that comes through in almost all aspects of the travel industry on that wonderful continent. It's a magical place, and I can't wait, like you, to get back. I can't wait for this COVID virus to be beaten.
And I cannot wait.
to get moving again. Our industry is taking a beating, and it's more than just the industry. When you think about the way those, and I'm going to refer to lodges primarily because they're the guys that are in the more extreme locations. They're in locations where very little other industry exists to support life, where communities for the longest time have subsisted off the land and have now been offered the opportunity for an education and employment. This is where the lodges exist. And for those guys who are out there soldiering through this coronavirus without any guests, looking at their bank balances diminishing every day, every week and every month as they have no income, I think about them and all the good that they've been doing, the principle of ecotourism, the principle of sustainable practices, and how that suffers. It's not just the tourism industry, the people that make up the tourism industry at the very end of the scale are the guys that end up suffering the most, who have to be furloughed and sent home without pay. And so this virus needs to end, and it needs to end fast, because without those people being employed, without the guides going out on safari, without the eyeballs and the feet on the ground, the parks are vulnerable. Poachers are able to reestablish themselves and go and harvest without much apprehension. And it's a very trying time. I know that nature will always find its balance and it will always exist, and things might disappear and come back one day. But this virus needs to go. We need to get tourism back on the march, hey?
Very quickly. Yes. When are you going back?
I suppose that's as soon as the airlines will allow us on an aeroplane. You know, we've got trade shows and things that I like to attend. You know, the Travel in Durban this year, which I think is probably Africa's biggest showcase, was cancelled or postponed, and that would have been my next trip. I'm likely to head back as soon as the virus is over. I would like to go and meet with the people I do business with over there just to reassure them that their interests have been well looked after in the States. I know Andy Hogg at the Bush Camp Company has done all sorts of interesting refurbs. I need to go and scope that out. I had a trip planned to go to Kwando to have a look at Sue Smart's new splash camp and the new Quarra camp. That's had to be put on hold until we can get back in. So, yeah, as soon as possible, Andy. Absolutely as soon as possible.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm ready. This is the longest time in 18 years in the industry that I have not been in the bush, and it's only been 3 months or 2.5. I got back on February 1st, so 2.5 months.
Yeah, you keep telling me that you want to manage your business more than operate your business, but I'm afraid you've got a guide's blood, and no matter how you try and extract yourself from doing that, it's in you. You're going to continue to do it.
I've tried to pull back and do more agent safari planning type work, and I was doing a good job of it last year, and finding a really nice balance between travel and being home and not exhausted or jet lagged. But I think that balance is going to go out the window for the next year and a half. When I can travel, I will have to, and will do so with a smile on my face.
Fantastic, Andy. Well, listen, I know we've been on the line for nearly an hour, so it's been a wonderful conversation, and I thank you very much for joining me on my new podcast called The Green Piece, and that is spelled P-I-E-C-E. Just for our listeners out there who are interested in connecting with Andy, his company is Andy Biggs Safaris and Custom Travel, and the best way to reach him is andybiggs.com. The internet does the rest for you. So there's a good place to go and be inspired, because the photography on Andy's website is legendary. It's quite beautiful. And even if you don't book with him, just go and have a look at his website and be inspired and salivate all over your QWERTY keyboard and imagine that one day you'll be jetting your way over to Africa. Who knows? You might even run across him on the plains of the Serengeti at some point.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Andy, great pleasure, man. Thanks very much, and have a great weekend. We'll catch up in later in the month.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Superman. Bye-bye.